A grim year of news has been punctuated with positive developments of late. It feels like almost every week we hear good news about a successful vaccine trial, and the UK rollout of the vaccine has surpassed all expectations with its speed and success. However, this weekend we got our first set of really bad news on the vaccine front. Results from a trial in South Africa have shown that, at least in terms of mild and moderate disease against their strain, the Oxford AstraZeneca jab is only 10% effective. On tonight's show, I'll be speaking to a professor of virology about what this means for the global struggle against the pandemic. That's not the only story we'll be talking about tonight, though. I'm also joined by Ash Sarkar. How are you doing, Ash?
I'm feeling good. Don't have the South African variant yet, so we'll see.
The good news for us, and we should say that we don't want to be, you know, scaring anyone. What the government was saying, what Matt Hancock and Jonathan Van Tam were saying, is that the strain that this is not effective against is not yet particularly widespread in Britain. So I would still get the AstraZeneca jab tomorrow if I was offered it. But on a global health perspective, I think this is potentially really bad. But I'm going to be talking to someone who knows more about this than myself. The Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine was supposed to be the key tool in escaping the coronavirus pandemic. Produced on a non-profit basis, it is the cheapest of the available vaccines, with 3.5 billion currently on order around the world. However, this weekend we got some really bad news. Against the strain of COVID-19 predominant in South Africa, the vaccine doesn't appear to stop infections from COVID-19. Now, it was a trial of 2,000 people, and it was shown that in that trial, 19 people who had had the vaccine got mild to moderate disease, 20 people who'd had the placebo got mild to moderate disease. So basically ineffective against catching it. There was not enough people on the trial to work out whether or not it prevents severe disease. So that's still an unknown. It was worrying enough, though, for the South African government to have paused plans to roll out that jab. I want to get up a graph for you now just to show you how significant this AstraZeneca vaccine is, because if it doesn't work against this strain, we've got lots of other vaccines that seem like they do. It's not like we give up on vaccines, but the AstraZeneca vaccine is quite special just because of how many people have ordered it. I think we can get this graphic up, which is from the FT, which is showing you all the top jabs and the amount that has been ordered of them. So as I've said, the AstraZeneca vaccine has about 3.5 billion on order. And it's particularly useful to look at the colors here, because you can see they're dark blue UK, light blue EU, or a different light blue US, and the red is other. So most of the developing world will be in that other category. And you can see that AstraZeneca there, that's where most of the developing world have invested their orders, or COVAX, potentially the World Health Organization's body. And that's because it was very cheap. You can see the next vaccine that has lots of orders from not Europe or the US is Novavax. We'll talk about that later. The mutation that makes the South African strain vaccine resistant is known as E484K. This is a mutation that develops, which seems to make it more resistant to all of the vaccines, but so much so to the AstraZeneca vaccine that it can't stop moderate disease. That's present in the Brazilian strain as well as the South African strain. It's also evolving separately in the Kent strain. So it's not necessarily confined to South Africa. To discuss this week's disappointing results, I'm joined by Professor of Virology at UCL, Dinen Pillay. Dinen is also a member of Independent Sage and has been on the show before. Thank you for coming back to talk to us, Dinen.
Hi, Michael and Ash.
Could I start by giving you, well, by getting your general sense of the significance of these results? So for me, I mean, it seems significant precisely because of how many people have ordered this vaccine. It seemed like lots of people were relying on this vaccine, which no longer seems capable of fighting against one of the main strains that are currently circulating.
Yes, you're right. It is a disappointing result. Having said that, it is a very small trial, as these trials go, for evaluating how good or not the vaccines are. The trial, in addition to being small, was in a younger age group, and that's why the number of, you know, severe cases were so small within the trial, and so there was no data. There are no data on that. And of course, it has led this, as you say, the South African government and their ministerial commission and advisors to withdraw the widespread rollouts of this vaccine. But Nevertheless, there is going to be a rollout and almost an evaluation in older people, in higher risk individuals, as the vaccine is rolled out. My understanding is that the doses that have been delivered will indeed be utilized, and we get information about that. But I think a broader point about this is that we're in danger of moving into this dichotomy between the vaccines being God or the vaccines being dog, either fantastic or completely useless. And we know that vaccines sit in between there. All vaccines that are currently used, none of them are 100% effective, and they vary in effectiveness. And I think we've also learned as we've gone along, we've been surprised to some extent the degree to which this coronavirus does vary, coronavirus that varies much more than what we assumed from understanding about other coronaviruses. And therefore, it does inform how we develop vaccines in future. And the final thing I'd say is that because it's not all or nothing, because the vaccines will always have some impact, whether it's higher or lower according different strains, that could nevertheless be useful for the population in reducing that peak mortality, that peak very severe illness. And we've got to bear that in mind. And that is why I think, like you said at the top of the show, is that we would always recommend individuals in the UK, listeners to this show, to be vaccinated with whatever vaccine is available, rather than not.
Well, I mean, my position is if it's safe, which they all are, then you can inject it into me, even if it is only 10% effective, because at least then it's 10% less likely. I want to talk a bit about the differences between AstraZeneca and the other vaccines and whether or not we've talked enough about changing which vaccines we focus production on. And before I go to you, I want to go to a clip from Sarah Gilbert. She's the lead scientist on the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. She suggested that the disappointing AstraZeneca results mean we might have to give up on vaccines stopping infections.
What we're seeing from other vaccine developers is that they have a reduction in efficacy against some of the variant viruses. And what that is looking like is that we may not be reducing the total number of cases, but there's still protection in that case against deaths, hospitalizations, and severe disease. So that pushes us more back to the first scenario with the pyramid of cases that I was talking about. Maybe we won't be reducing the number of cases as much, but we still won't be seeing the deaths, the hospitalizations, and the severe disease. And that's really important for healthcare systems, even if we're having mild and asymptomatic infections, to prevent people from going into hospital with COVID would have a major effect.
What I thought was a bit odd about that, and which I didn't really understand, is that she seems to be talking about the AstraZeneca vaccine like it's the same as all the other vaccines. So she's saying, well, what we're seeing now is that vaccines, they're potentially not that good at stopping infection of the new strain, but they might be good at stopping hospitalization. But from the results we've seen, some of the vaccines are quite good at stopping infections. And from the results we've seen, we don't know anything about AstraZeneca and whether it stops severe disease. I want to get up something that I thought was very helpful, which was a table put up by Eric Topol, he's editor of Medscape, which showed us the results of various trials up against these new strains, and which, I mean, to me would suggest that maybe we should just invest in different vaccines. I'll be putting that to someone who knows more than me in one moment. But let's go through this because I found this very useful. So this is the trials in South Africa. So against the South African strain, you've got the Novavax vaccine. There were 4,000 people in that trial, and it was shown to have 60% efficacy. This is for moderate to mild disease for people who are HIV negative, slightly less if you're HIV positive. Now, that is less effective than it was in the UK, where it's 89% effective, but still very effective. And there were enough people in that trial to tell us that it does stop hospitalizations and deaths. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine, you had 10,000 people in that trial. That was 52% effective. Now, again, that's still less than the strain that's dominant in the US, where it's 72%, but that's effective. It's only once you get to the AstraZeneca one, where it doesn't seem to be stopping infections, it's only 10% effective. We can also see there, he's showing the data against the United Kingdom strain, so what we know as the Kent strain, and there, Novavax, with 15,000 participants, it was 86% efficacious against the Kent strain versus 96% against the original strain. And AstraZeneca was 75% efficacious against the Kent strain versus 84% against the original. Pfizer and BioNTech, they don't appear on there. That's because there hasn't been any trials with real people there out in the wild, as it were. But they have shown that in labs, they think that will be effective. So to me, and I want to put this to you, Dean, and to me, it seems like we might be overthinking the general limitations of vaccines. And actually, it's just the case that the AstraZeneca vaccine, whilst it's good enough in Britain right now, it's not really good enough in general. And so maybe we should be thinking about switching supply. We've got 3.5 billion AstraZeneca doses on order. Should we be trying to say, actually, let's scale that back and invest heavily in Novavax?
That's great. And Eric Topol's side is a good summary. And a lot of his work is summarizing this very well. My take on this is twofold. Firstly, when it comes to comparing trials in the way and the data from trials in the way that you've just demonstrated, it's bloody difficult to do because trials which are formal, they're formal structures and in terms of evaluating a new drug or in this case a new vaccine, are complicated things that are structured in a way to demonstrate with statistical power and as much statistical certainty as possible that taking the vaccine is better than the placebo. And of course, what we're comparing here are not just whether the vaccine's better or not, is what proportion of people get a benefit from it. But comparing between trials, comparing that percentage for one vaccine versus a percentage for another vaccine, is very difficult because the sorts of characteristics of individuals who are recruited into these trials may very well be different. They may be different risk groups, different age stratifications, different disadvantaged backgrounds, or different genetic backgrounds, which may determine the efficacy. And that is why it's really difficult to do these comparisons. And I should say, I would summarize the situation we're in as on the one hand, it's fantastic that we've got so many vaccines coming to this level of maturity that now they're becoming available. That's just fantastic. And it's really literally within a year of the virus first being identified and the genetic sequence being published. And I think that's a strength of the pandemic planning and the multilateral approaches that have been taken by the WHO primarily, as well as other players, to stimulate industry to work with academics in this space. What the downside of that approach, where we're still basing it on commercial large pharmaceutical companies, is, of course, it's in no one's interest to actually start to compare vaccines against each other before it's shown that one vaccine is effective. And therefore, we don't have a level playing field in doing all these comparisons, if you get what I mean. We're not comparing one vaccine to another vaccine. We're comparing one vaccine to placebo multiple different times in different ways. So that's my take on this. Having said that, it is my sense, looking at the way that the virus evolves and mutates, and we've got to remember that variants are not stuck in history and therefore with us forever, is there continues to be an evolution. And that's why, for instance, the 484 mutation that you mentioned earlier is now being, which was characteristic of the South African, what's called the South African variant, is now being seen on the background of other variants that are circulating, is that is continually going to happen. And it does seem we're moving very rapidly to a situation which is akin to flu vaccine, influenza vaccine, which is we look at what each year, what viruses are circulating, what influenza viruses are circulating. And that winter, we've prepared the vaccines that will be given to any one population based on what's been circulating. And it does seem that that's the route that we're moving to with COVID, in that more maybe annual vaccinations, which will be for, you know, high-risk populations, but also maybe broader populations within society, which will be updated each year by the key variants that are circulating.
Let's talk a bit about what this means for the UK in the short term, and we're going to visit this again via the medium of clips, this time of our political leaders. So this is Boris Johnson today speaking to the press, trying to reassure the public, I think.
We think that all the vaccines that we're using, both the vaccines that we're currently using, are effective in, as I say, in stopping serious disease and death. We also think, in particular in the case of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, that there's good evidence that it is stopping transmission as well. I think 67% reduction in transmission with the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. So they remain of a massive benefit to our country and the population as we go through the pandemic. And I've no doubt that vaccines generally are going to offer the way out. And with every day that goes by, you can see that medicine is slowly getting the upper hand over the disease.
So what he sort of said there is that we know the vaccines that are currently in this country are effective against the dominant strains in this country. Also says that the vaccines we have here, we know they protect against severe disease. As I've already, you know, explained, it's actually an unknown whether they protect against severe disease when it's the South African strain. So it seems quite important that we don't get that many new strains in the meantime before we update these vaccines, which is probably why Keir Starmer responded like this.
I think the South African variant is the single biggest risk at the moment. And it's very important, therefore, that we secure our borders. We've known about the South African variant for some time. If you can believe it, it's going to be 50 days from knowing about the variant to border restrictions, quarantine and hotels coming in. And even between now, today, and those restrictions coming in, 200,000 people are going to come into the country. Add to that, and this is probably the most significant thing, a number of other countries we now know have the South African variant, and they're not even in the government scheme for quarantining in hotels. This is leaving a back door open at a vital stage in the battle against the virus.
We've talked a number of times on this show about how the government's policy on quarantining travellers is not particularly watertight. What I want to ask you, though, Dina, because this is a virology question that's completely, I've got no idea about. I can do policy. I can't do, you know, virology. You know, the argument Starmer's making there and a similar, the argument Johnson's making there really as well is that as long as we can keep out this strain, we'll be fine. But it also seems that the strains we've currently got in this country are independently evolving to have this 484 mutation. So I suppose my question is, how quickly could that happen? You know, how quickly could the UK strains become basically the same as the South African strain in functional terms when you're talking about whether or not it can resist the vaccine?
Well, that's a really good question. I think both Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson, you know, got it a bit wrong in those clips. Yes, we need to vaccinate as many people as possible. And yes, currently the evidence is the vaccines, the array of vaccines we have will be effective in doing that. But the variation, you know, the genetic variation, which contributes then to what are called new variants, and there's thousands of variants out there. We've just sort of we've honed down on a UK or a South African or a Brazilian variant, but they're variants all over the place. And we've got to remember that those variants only emerge and develop and the risk of new variants if the virus is able to continue to replicate. And if the virus continues to replicate by transmitting from person to person. So as an extreme example, we don't hear of all these variants in New Zealand. Why? Because there's no transmission in New Zealand, you know. So this is where a vaccine itself is not just the answer. The vaccine must come along with policies and the policies to significantly reduce transmission. And of course, part of that is border controls. And border controls is both about protecting the UK, but it's also protecting the rest of the world, stopping people from the high prevalence country we're in the UK, taking these viruses elsewhere. And so these two things must go together. So the idea, again, coming back to Boris Johnson clip, that it's medicine that's going to, that mantra coming back to it's science that's going to take us and get us out of this, it's medicine that's going to get us out of this. It is medicine, but within an infrastructure where there's strong public health control of ongoing transmission. That is the way that we get out of this. It will never be vaccines alone, for the reasons that we've now discussed, that these new variants developing in South Africa or identified in South Africa, which we don't know where they developed in South Africa. They're called South African variants because that is where the genetic characterization first went on. Equally in Brazil. But we know that what is called the South African variant is present in something like 10 or 15 countries around the African continent, as well as the UK and elsewhere now. So the idea that border controls is for a country rather than across the world and is bilateral with all nations is nonsense, really. We've got to actually control both infection transmission within our society, within our community, as well as limit the movement of these viruses around the world. And that will ensure that we can almost keep up with developing vaccines, updating vaccines, and being able to provide those vaccines to protect us all.
You can see why Boris Johnson wants to say, look, science is going to save us. This is now out of my hands. Sorry if I fucked up earlier. But as you put very eloquently, that's probably not the case. Ash, I want to bring you in because I know you've got a question you've been waiting to ask.
What happens after you see data like this, which suggests that a vaccine is less efficacious? Considering what we know about long COVID, that you can get it even if you've had a mild or moderate case of the disease, from a public health perspective, is it better to react quickly and perhaps overreact and go, okay, we're going to scrap that in favor of the other vaccines, which we know are more efficacious against things like the South African variant? Or is the wiser thing to just go on with the vaccine rollout as planned and keep an eye on consequences and react after that?
Yeah, good question there. I think this has got to be taken into the context of what other vaccines are available. So, for instance, you know, we've heard about the at the European level, I think Macron saying the AstraZeneca vaccine is no good for the over 65s, you know, which was disputed by both the company and the scientists. And obviously we're giving it in the UK to the over 65s. But that was in the context of other supply chains that they had of other vaccines. So in a way, this separates out the science from this, from the scientific policy of what is available and what can be given. Clearly, it's very sensitive. So the South Africans, I mean, and we've not talked about so far, when come back to South Africa, we've not talked about the huge discrepancy in availability of vaccines and the fact that we're moving really, however much the companies wanted vaccines to be available for the whole world, that's clearly not happened. And there's a, you know, inequality, not only within societies, but also between countries has been exacerbated here. So I think, you know, I'm sensitive to not over guessing or over advising from my perspective of what countries should do. But I think I would be surprised if South Africa, for instance, doesn't go ahead and roll this out. I do think that some antibodies or some immunity is going to be beneficial compared to no immunity. And we've got to remember as well that one of the contexts, the more sort of virological context here, is that when SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, did start to emerge from bats and however it got into humans through to humans, it was almost like the human population is naive to this, has never seen this virus before. And that's what's also driven the transmission and the severe disease. And I suspect that as soon as there starts to be some level of antibodies, even if they're partially effective, they will start to attenuate the disease. For instance, if you've already had the vaccine and the vaccine may not be 100%, maybe poorly effective, but then when you get your next, you come across the virus, that will stimulate more antibodies and it may then protect you for future variants. So all of these things are uncertain. It's very difficult to do trials about this, but I do think we should, in terms of that, come back to your question, whether we should respond immediately in a knee-jerk fashion. I think that would be wrong. I think the vaccines are demonstrating that they provide some protection, and that is important not only for the here and now, but also for the future.
I think that was actually a very good note to end on, because we haven't concluded that AstraZeneca is a dud, wherever you are in the world. Dean and Pillay, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Incredibly insightful and informative.
A pleasure. Take care, everyone.
We are going to go on to our next story. John Woodcock is a former Labour MP who endorsed the Tories at the 2019 general election and was rewarded with a seat in the House of Lords. He was also appointed UK Special Envoy for Countering Violent Extremism at the Home Office. And this weekend, we've learned he's been tasked with a new pet project. Woodcock, who left Labour while subject to an investigation into sexual harassment, has been put in charge of an investigation into political extremism on the left and the right. This was a story in The Telegraph. Exclusive far-left influence on Black Lives Matter and Extinction Rebellion to be probed. And it will report to Boris Johnson and Priti Patel, to whom Woodcock will present both his findings and his recommendations. And we can go to that article now. It states, unveiling his probe in an interview with The Telegraph, he warned that the UK must heed the growth of the far right in the US, which culminated in the storming of the Capitol last month. On the other end of the political spectrum, however, he stressed, we must be vigilant against a similar blind spot in Britain to the prospect of progressive extremism, that is, unacceptable disruption or even violence carried out in the name of progressive causes to which the political establishment and large majority of the population have great sympathy, like climate change and racial injustice. Now, there's lots of boxes being ticked there, an equivocation between left and right. There's no specification at all as to what counts as unacceptable disruption. That makes it quite possible to equate someone issuing death threats with people blocking roads or pulling down statues. Two very different kettles of fish. Civil disobedience is disruptive, yes, but it also has a place in any democracy, including liberal democracy, including to liberal theorists like John Rawls. Not my favorite philosopher, by the way. I'm just saying this isn't a far left thing. Now, it also seems, and this is just as worrying, that the report will go into plenty of areas which really shouldn't be the government's business at all. So let's go to a quote. This is about environmentalism. So he says, this is John Woodcock, there have been a number of, at the moment, isolated examples of climate change activist groups, particularly Extinction Rebellion, overstepping the mark into antisocial behaviour. I think there's been a recognition that even among that movement, they have at times risked undermining their own cause. I'm coming at this with an open mind, but with an understanding that there is clearly a potential for groups to develop into increasingly problematic areas. Now, one, I mean, given John Woodcock's behavior over the past 5 years, the moment Jeremy Corbyn was elected, he was doing everything in his power to destroy him. I'm not sure how open-minded a fella he is. But more importantly here, what he's talking about there should have nothing to do with the government. We'll often say on this show, oh, we think this particular action by Extinction Rebellion backfired. People in Extinction Rebellion will say that, that when they sort of jumped on a tube train, that probably made them more enemies than friends and the message was a bit weird. But that shouldn't be the subject of a government investigation. You don't need to be making recommendations to the government because someone climbed on a tube train and that might have lost the cause support. No, the government is there to say, if you broke the law, then we will try you for that. Not to say we think what you did was unstrategic and therefore we're going to use the, you know, the levers of the state to make you do something different. All very bizarre. It also bleeds, I mean, really into the extremely disingenuous. Remember, this is a report by John Cook to Boris Johnson and Priti Patel. And this one's about Black Lives Matter. Lord Walney, which is the name of him in the House of Lords for some reason. I need to look that up, really. Lord Walney also raised concerns that the leadership of Black Lives Matter UK have pushed a very hard line, an absolutist view about defunding the police, which he predicted was a world away from where the vast majority of BLM supporters would be. That niche agenda risks taking attention away from really legitimate and urgent debates on reform, which may need to be had about racism and wider society, he said. Now, Ash, I want to bring you in on this. John Woodcock is saying he's writing a report giving recommendations to Priti Patel and Boris Johnson to stop people in Black Lives Matter doing unstrategic moves, which could alienate them from the broader racial justice struggle.
You'd think that he'd stay away from phrases like independent investigation, you know, considering the circumstances under which he left the Parliamentary Labour Party. But I digress. Look, this is absolutely not the business of the state. There are already laws in place to deal with the kind of disruption which you see from civil disobedience, be it obstruction of a public highway or trespassing and so on and so forth. Quite recently, we've had a case where the Crown Prosecution Service really overstepped the mark in trying to crack down on a form of civil disobedience. Now, the act of the Stansted 15 to lie on the runway and disrupt a deportation charter flight was an unlawful act. But there are laws to deal with, you know, trespassing in an airport. In order to seek out a greater punishment, perhaps in recognition of the political dimension of the act. Initially, the protesters were convicted under a section of terrorism legislation. Now, at an appeal, I think just last week, the week before, that was overturned. And the judge explicitly said, you know, there was no case to answer in this regard, you know, dismissed it out of hand. So I think that it's really worth pointing out that the way in which laws are used are already pretty, you know, proportionate in this country. And if you try and overextend that, you will get some kind of resistance from the judiciary in terms of not getting that balance right between upholding the law and allowing for civil disobedience, which happens in a democratic society. Now, taking a step back and thinking about the politics of this, what is this all about? I think it comes back to a point that I've made quite a few times about the right's attempt to redraw the boundaries of acceptable politics. Some people call it the Overton window. I prefer talking about Gramsci. And it's about redefining universal values in a shared common sense. Now, they've tried to do it in terms of reshaping institutions and what they're for. We've talked about this in relation to Ofcom and the Charities Commission. Now you've got a kind of state-mandated acceptable protest, which extends beyond just the means which are used to carry out the protest, but also the goals of the protest and the demands of the protest. It's not the state's business to decide what a reasonable demand from BLM is. BLM can demand that the Queen is replaced with, I don't know, Mega Man, right? It's up to them. In a democratic society, you've got protest groups deciding what it is that they want to pursue. And, you know, within the means which are available to them, for me, there's, you know, a strategically non-violent means. Go ahead. It doesn't matter if you consider them more alienating than not, John Woodcock. And there's a third thing that I want to sort of talk about, which is the way in which the history of protest movements, it's deliberately misremembered. So I don't think that John Woodcock would look back at, say, the Freedom Riders who protested segregation in the United States in the 60s and say, "Ooh, you guys have really overstepped the mark here. I think you're alienating some of the people who could be convinced." Well, he probably wouldn't say that now. But back in the day, the majority of white Americans had a very negative opinion of the tactics which were carried out by the Freedom Riders, which now we look back on and we celebrate. Similarly with ACT UP, who conducted die-ins in protest of the government's inaction with response to the AIDS crisis. You know, these are actions which didn't have a particularly hospitable reception at the time they were happening. And so that's not to say that every time something disruptive is done in the name of protest, that it's necessarily a good idea. There are political differences. But the fact is, if you think that it's always obvious what's going to be remembered kindly by history and what's not, and that answer is going to be made obvious to you because of where the polling is, you are absolutely laughing. That's never happened at any point in history. So yeah, I think it's idiotic. I think it's overstepping, but I also think it's part of quite a sinister project. And the reason why John Woodcock is involved, this is my take, is that perhaps he's been left with some kind of lasting antipathy following his marginalization and then departure from the Labour Party. And there is an element to which former Labour figures like himself and also like Lord Ian Austin are being used as a means to sort of make sure that the left will never be as powerful again as when it accidentally captured the leadership of the Labour Party.
I think in a way, John Woodcock being involved in a sinister project, that might be something that sui generis explains itself, because he is no stranger to siding with very, very sinister characters to carry out very awful misdeeds. This one is clearly, the one I'm about to show is clearly on a completely different scale to this report. I don't want to say they're in any way compared. But John Woodcock is quite famous in Westminster for being the closest MP, or at the time he was an MP, to the leadership of Saudi Arabia. So he has met King Salman of Saudi Arabia and sort of said gushing things about him, very praising of sort of the reforms that were being done. He sort of celebrates this relationship because he says it helps BAE sell weapons. Now, those are the same weapons, of course, that are being used to bomb Yemen, a war which John Woodcock has explicitly defended. So when Jeremy Corbyn stood up in Parliament and said, you know, we should freeze sales to Saudi Arabia, because they're bombing Yemen and it's leaving literally millions of people at the brink of starvation. Now, there have been so many credible accusations of war crimes against the Saudis in that Yemeni conflict because they did things like bomb civilian infrastructure, which left people at the brink of starvation. He stood up in Parliament, John Woodcock, and said, oh no, if we stop selling them weapons, that would just mean that they were less targeted. It would mean that they'd be sort of more sloppy in their use of weapons and that would kill more civilians. It's well documented that they've intentionally bombed civilians and civilian infrastructure. So you've got this person who is standing up there saying, I am going to defend this incredibly, I mean, it's an extremist dictatorship, right? It's an Islamist dictatorship and one which has no respect for human rights and one which is very willing and has a great proclivity to bomb other countries into smithereens. And now he is the, you know, the envoy against extremism. It's like through the looking glass. You could not make it up. And I'm glad you actually, Ash, that you brought up the other characters who were ennobled by the Conservatives, because John Woodcock isn't alone. It's John Woodcock, Ian Austin, and Kate Hoey. They are three former Labour MPs who in the 2019 general election endorsed the Conservatives. Within a year, they had all been given peerages and were sitting quite comfortably in the House of Lords. I mean, it really tells you the nature of these people, that they left their political party to back someone else who they've said, oh, our whole life was against their politics. And then they get quite a handy reward from them afterwards. Ian Austin and John Woodcock were like actively going around with this banner saying we're against extremism, don't vote for Jeremy Corbyn. And then they just get rewarded straight afterwards. It's not subtle. It's explicit.
I mean, that's the thing about, you know, corruption in this country. It's just so in your face that people often feel like, well, if it was really corruption, it wouldn't be so obvious. So we've got to give it a different kind of name. But three people have been rewarded with a permanent seat in the upper house of our legislature. £300 a day until the day they die, simply because they were of political strategic value to Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings. Now, I personally don't think that's how an upper house should work. And this point, so I think, you know, bigger problems in our democracy. We're going to move on to the big one at the top of it, Miss QE2 herself. But this is another one. It's that it's such a porous system, open to abuse. You know, it's not actually that long since we had the Cash for Honours scandal back in the heady days of New Labour. It's always been a pretty grim and dirty business. But to now see those same figures. Oh, John Mann, that's who we forgot.
John Mann, that's who we forgot. I knew there was a missing link.
John Mandem. You know, he's another one who is sort of, you know, using his position to try and bring in ever more sort of expansive definitions of anti-Semitism and sort of, I think, looking at institutions like universities and left-wing organizations and so on and so forth. I think that that constitutes a threat to freedom of expression. But again, it's about trying to make sure that you place the left in such narrow confines that the phenomena of Corbyn couldn't happen twice. That's what it's about. And that's why it's being led by these figures.
Absolutely. Quite scary, really, isn't it? I suppose this is a good time. I don't want to scare you into subscribing to Navarra Media, but at the same time, I do think that if you want a counter narrative to the kind sort of pushed out by these very, very cynical people, then it does help to have an independent media. So if you are already a supporter of Navarra Media, thank you so much. If not, please go to navarramedia.com/support and donate the equivalent of 1 hour's wage a month. Ash said our next story goes right to the top, and boy, was she correct. Britain is a democracy, and the role of our hereditary royals is supposed to be purely symbolic. However, a very interesting Guardian investigation has revealed that on multiple occasions, the royals have lobbied to effect legislation to protect their own interests. The first story, which broke on Sunday, shows that in the 1970s, the Queen successfully lobbied to modify legislation that would have led to the scale of her wealth becoming public. Now, the legislation in question was intended to stop investors from secretly building up significant stakes in listed companies by acquiring their shares through front companies or nominees. To that end, it gave company directors the power to say, if you're investing money in my company, I want to know who you represent. So you couldn't basically have a sort of secret underhand takeover. Now, at this point, the Queen saw a threat, because she thought that this could give company directors basically the power to find out what the Queen might have owned or what the Queen might be investing in. So the Guardian, right, they continue. Following the Queen's intervention, the government inserted a clause into the law granting itself the power to exempt companies used by heads of state from the new transparency measures. The arrangement was used in effect to create a state-backed shell corporation, which is understood to have placed a veil of secrecy over the Queen's private shareholdings and investments until at least 2011. Now, this article, I do recommend reading it. It has loads of documentary evidence that the changes were due to lobbying from the Crown. We're not going to go into all of the details now. What I'm going to do, though, is just explain to you how this was possible. No, what was the constitutional arrangement that gives, and still gives, in fact, the Queen power to lobby parliamentarians based on legislation that she thinks could be of detriment to herself or the Crown in general, not necessarily the person of the Queen. And the mechanism they use is called Queen's consent. Now, I'd heard of royal assent, but not Queen's consent. Royal assent is the situation where once a law is passed, then you have to get the Queen's consent to or assent before it becomes a law. So you will have, you might remember when Parliament was prorogued, there was this sort of kind of deranged campaign on the internet from first past the post, not first past the post, it's follow back pro EU people to say, we want the Queen to not give the bill which prorogued Parliament royal assent. They thought she might intervene from above. She doesn't do that because it'd be very explicit. If you've had Parliament pass a law and then she says, oh no, I'm not going to put that into law. I'm not going to give that royal assent. Then you've got a constitutional crisis. What's different about Queen's consent is that it's sought before the legislation goes to Parliament. So they have to show her the legislation if they think it could affect her interests. And that's at the point at which she can lobby. That means it happens behind the scenes. It's not particularly public. That means it's possible. Now, The Guardian show the Queen has sought prior sight of legislation using Queen's consent over 1,000 times. That was most recently used on the European Union bill passed last December. We don't know if she lobbied to change anything on that one. Obviously, these are the Guardian story are based on documents that don't get released until a few decades after they're originally written, which means they don't have proof she lobbied on many of these instances. They cite 4 instances in the 70s and the 80s involving traffic rules on the royal estates and national heritage sites where intervention is proven to have happened. Also, they say when asked by The Guardian, the Queen's representatives refused to say how many times she had requested alterations to legislation since she came to the throne. So they're not saying they have changed laws. They're not saying they haven't. They're saying notably silent on this. Now, Ash, this isn't quite as shocking as the royals' treatment of Diana, but should we be worried about this aristocratic threat to our democracy?
I think this is why being even indifferent to the existence of a hereditary monarchy is completely incompatible with a belief in democracy or equality. And this is why I feel so angry that the left has worn its republicanism with such embarrassment in recent years. You know, Keir Starmer rolling back from comments he made in earlier years where he was very much a Republican, now sort of saying, you know, oh, the Queen is a symbol of great hope to many. Hope to do what? To be able to skew legislation in your favour without any oversight from anybody else in a way that no other private citizen would be able to do. Is that what we aspire to? I mean, I do aspire to be like rich and idle like the rest of the royal family, but that's kind of where it ends. And I think that what's going to happen in coming years as one, more of these stories come out, and some of them will come out, you know, probably after the Queen has passed on and we've got, you know, King Charles III, is that that combination of the person who has really sort of been this grandmother of a nation figure to, you know, all of us, who we've only ever known as kind of this older and very, very depoliticized figure, the combination of this kind of information coming out coupled with a king who doesn't have the same kind of popularity, I think. He's a more polarizing figure. He himself has been sort of involved in the Black Spider memos. We still don't know what they concerned, where he was perhaps lobbying a government of the day, which is not something that the royal family are supposed to do. But that could actually be a moment where you do have a resurgence in Republican sentiment. And I do hope that there is more space created to share these opinions and not, you know, be looked at as if you've just drowned one of the Andrex puppies. You know, republicanism isn't motivated by a desire for cruelty or to be really mean to this nice old lady is motivated by a desire to have a modern functioning democracy where you don't have someone who is both unelected, a head of state, and hugely wealthy and able to make sure that laws don't interrupt with the accumulation of that wealth.
To be Republican is seen as an extremist position in this country. It's not only that a majority of people are for keeping the royals. If you are, for example, you know, high up in the Labour Party and you suggest that maybe we shouldn't have a hereditary monarch as head of state who also has loads of money and quite a lot of power, then you're like, that's crazy. It's like you're in the 1700s, like in France, where it's sort of like to say off with the head of the king. Obviously, we don't want to get off her head. She seems nice enough. To say we shouldn't have a royal, that's out of, you know, that's almost out of the, it's not the Overton window. What was the word you used, the Gramscian one, Ash?
So it's, you know, completely illegitimate and outside the boundaries of, you know, acceptable opinion and political position. But, you know, it's not, you know, you talked about, you know, it's an extremist position like in France. It actually really wasn't an extremist position at the time. Obviously, what happened with the Reign of Terror was, you know, a touch more polarizing. But because of the excesses of the French court at that time, the political instability, the poverty, the hunger, you know, this idea that you could have a modern functioning democracy and that would help people flourish, it actually wasn't, you know, super duper extreme at the time. Obviously, we live in very different circumstances. The nature of our monarchy is different, or at least it should be. But the fact that it exists at all allows for these loopholes, which constitute and facilitate, I think, an abuse and misuse of her power as a constitutional monarch. And that's not something that you can get rid of just by switching the personalities at the top. So, you know, for instance, you know, she, you know, leaves the stage and Prince Charles comes on, or Prince William, or I don't know what his kids are called, George, you know, or George or whatever, that you can sort of deal with these excesses. It's built into the entire thing, right? It is in the DNA of a constitutional monarchy that in some ways you undermine proper democratic practice and oversight. And I don't think that that's an extreme opinion. You know, all I'm saying is go be rich on your own time.
We're going to go on to, you know, a character who's potentially even, you know, further in the, you know, the fabric of the British establishment than the Queen, which is Sir Keir Starmer. We dedicated much of Friday's show to Keir Starmer's leadership wobble, with people briefing against him from left and right and focus groups left confused as to what he stands for. Now, this weekend, the drama continued as the Times revealed Starmer's team had thought of an original ploy to rebuild momentum for the party and for his leadership. What did they think of? Coming out as pro business. Has anyone thought of this before? If only the Labour Party came out as pro-business, everything would have been okay. We would have been in power for the last 11 years. Let's go to some text from that report. The Times write, in a strategy that will do little to endear him to the left of the party, the Labour leader is preparing to park his tanks on the Tories' lawn by unveiling a bold pro-business policy agenda before next month's budget. It is understood that this will include tax cuts for firms and a pledge to extend the business rates holiday to help companies struggling amid the coronavirus pandemic. A leaked email from Claire Ainslie, Starmer's director of policy, which has been seen by the Sunday Times, warns, "We won't recover if the Tories raid family finances with universal credit cuts, forcing councils to hike up council tax or freezing key worker pay. But we also won't recover if we just stand by as businesses go bust. To be the party of working people and their communities, Labour must be unashamedly pro-business to drive growth and opportunity in every part of our country." Ash, what do you make of this? I don't think many of our audience would be surprised that when Starmer sort of, you know, the first rocky patch he's encountered, he's decided, I know what I'll do. I'll be unashamedly pro-business. No fault to the fact that potentially the reason why young people and Labour activists are annoyed at him is maybe because he kicked out Jeremy Corbyn, or because he hasn't offered really any opposition to the Tories during this pandemic. No, the problem is we haven't got business executives on side quite enough. Let's offer some tax cuts.
This really does feel like Groundhog Day. Keir Starmer made this exact same announcement about being pro-business at the beginning of his leadership. So it's not just that, you know, what we're seeing is microwaved Milibandism. It, it really is. What we're seeing is reheated Starmerism, you know, this recycling of tropes and talking points, an attempt to sort of distance himself from what he sees as the Corbynite legacy. Well, this isn't even a fresh way to do that. So I think what this indicates is someone who really is at a loss for ways to sort of revive a plateauing leadership. He's having to nick from his own ideas. But as for this thing about being microwave Milibandism, I remember when Ed Balls was going around to anyone who'd listen saying that he was ferociously pro-business. I think under Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, you know, it was said that Labour was, you know, unashamedly pro-business, pathologically pro-business, neurotically pro-business, you know, just new adjectives every single time. And what it fails to do is actually come up with a set of policies which would be, you know, concretely supportive of small to medium businesses, which are struggling. We've seen that with the death of the high street, the sort of tendency towards, you know, kind of big retail monopolies, which do disadvantage smaller businesses. And also disadvantage the workforce. None of us are saying, you know, hey, it's really great when, you know, your local shop, which has been there for 40 years, goes bust. What we're saying is that, well, hang on, in order to sort of protect those smaller business, to prevent the accumulation of monopoly capital and the outsize, you know, political clout those businesses have, you've got to be the party of labor. You've got to be the party of the workforce. And I think that Keir Starmer's really struggled to articulate that in any meaningful sense. And part of the reason why is because the section of voters that he's targeting are retired homeowners, pensioners. They're not people who, you know, are in the workforce anymore. So this is the kind of platitude which, you know, he hopes is going to reassure people who had their feathers ruffled by John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn. John McDonnell also, by the way, you know, made his overtures to the business community. I kind of remember his, you know, tea time wooing initiatives towards the city. He tried to sort of rebrand himself as, you know, the people's bank manager a bit.
But it wasn't just John McDonnell, because you've gone through previous Labour leaders who tried to court business. You had Blair, Brown and Miliband, but it wasn't just them. This is Jeremy Corbyn speaking to the Confederation of British Industry during the 2019 general election.
It is sometimes claimed that I am anti-business. Actually, this is nonsense. It's not anti-business to be against poverty pay. It's not anti-business to say that the largest corporations should pay their taxes just as smaller companies do. And it's not anti-business to want prosperity in every part of our country, not only in the financial centres of the City of London. And I say this to business too. If a Labour government is elected on the 12th of December, you're going to see more investment than you've ever dreamt of. You're going to have the best educated workforce you could ever have hoped for. And you're going to get the world-leading infrastructure, including full fibre broadband, you've long, long demanded year after year at these conferences.
He did have a good point, which is to say that if you are pro-business, not necessarily pro the big monopolistic, you know, parasitic businesses, landlords, and are just sort of getting money for not doing very much, if you're interested in the productive economy, then having high wages, which means that people have purchasing power, means that firms invest in productivity, having a government that's willing to invest in new technologies, that is really good, actually, for the businesses that most people care about. So, you know, it was a good argument, and we still haven't seen, you know, what Starmer's specifically Labour pitch is on this question. We're going to keep on the theme of Keir Starmer and his little wobble, because it revealed itself, let's say, in some polling figures today. So these were all released today. I'm going to show you polls from YouGov, where the Conservatives are on 41 and Labour are on 37. You can see there that the Conservatives are up 4 and Labour are down 4. Not necessarily a straight switch, because the Greens are also up 2, but those polls aren't moving in the right direction. If you're thinking maybe that's just an outlier, and again, we can't guarantee it's not, but we also have this poll from Ipsos Mori, the same direction of travels. The Conservatives on 42, that's 1 up from the previous poll, and Labour on 38, which is down 3. And again, the Greens doing pretty well. They're on 8 points. The final one I want to show you is, would Keir Starmer make the best prime minister? This has been the source of polling, which most people, myself included, have been pointing to say Keir Starmer's team won't be unhappy with this. They still won't be distraught by this, but Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson are now level pegging on who would make the best prime minister. 33 points each. Keir Starmer down one, Boris Johnson up four. Presumably this has a lot to do with the rollout of the vaccine. I'm not really sure if the electorate were looking that closely at a leak about Union Jacks. It's probably something more fundamental than that. For context, for that, who is the best prime minister, Britain's elect put together a nice handy record of YouGov over time, who they found was people's preferred prime minister. So you can see there that there was a period at the beginning of the pandemic where Keir Starmer sort of dramatically caught up with Boris Johnson. Then their rating sort of danced with each other for a few months. And Boris Johnson's now on the way up. Ash, we shouldn't really overinterpret polls, which are just going up and down a bit. But there is this impression now that Keir Starmer has lost momentum and also confidence. Like maybe his, I mean, if he ever had a mojo, I don't know if Keir Starmer ever had a mojo, but if he did, he's kind of lost it.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that he had a mojo. Maybe sort of a hint of a vibe somewhere. I wouldn't go as far
an
as
an air of authority, at least.
An air of confidence and authority. At the moment, he and his team are looking increasingly rattled. They're casting about for ideas. Nothing's really working. And it's because their strategy of present competence, a political image rather than a policy story, that's how you're going to win over those Labour to Tory switches who were decisively, lost in 2019. That isn't being borne out in, you know, much of the polling at all. It's maybe 4% of those switches being won back, but there's no significant dents. And meanwhile, you've got a kind of steady seeping of progressive votes towards, you know, Applied and towards the Greens. I imagine for younger people, that's something which might exacerbate. That's, of course, if they don't just switch to non-voting entirely. And on the question of, you know, individual poll ratings, well, if you're saying that your big thing is I'm more competent than the other guy and you don't have a sense of a policy vision, well, what happens when the other guy actually gets something right, like vaccine procurement, like the vaccine rollout? You know, that's really given people, no pun, a shot in the arm and a sense of optimism. Did you like that?
That was very good.
You know, a sense of optimism, you know, looking forward to summer, looking forward to being able to, you know, reunite with their families, see their friends, do all the things that they want to do. This idea of I'd be better if I was in charge because, you know, I'm just a kind of more competent and together guy doesn't really work when people are going, actually, the government got something right. The sort of disavowal of vision, and I think that it is a deliberate strategy on the part of Keir's team, I think is really, really flawed. Because I think the starting point that they work from is that the electorate is essentially passive. They respond to images and not policy. They don't really care about what you're going to be like governing the country and how their lives are going to be different outside of, you know, the run-up to election day. So before that, you may as well not say anything. Just don't fuck up too much and, you know, project a sense of authority. And the thing that's really flawed about that is that, one, you're not really diverging from the government, because if you want to look authoritative, the best thing to be is already in power. And the second thing is that if what you're trying to do is reclaim terrain that's been lost because of 40 years of economic drift, where you've got, you know, one section of, you know, the population who tend to be older, you know, enriched by asset price inflation and the protection of their pensions, and the majority of the workforce excluded from wealth, from economic stability and security, you're not going to deal with that in any meaningful sense if you just say, well, you know, my tactic is going to be don't spook the boomers. If what you want to do is sort of stage a political upset and put together an electoral coalition capable of winning, you're going to have to, in some ways, you know, represent the economic interests of the working age population and appeal to them on the basis of policy. Wrapping yourself up in a flag isn't going to cut it. Trying to just look better in a suit than Boris Johnson or Jeremy Corbyn isn't going to cut it. And punching left, you know, trying to demonstrate your own competence by going, you know, look how often I can make Rebecca Long Bailey cry, isn't going to cut it either. It keeps you caught in that place of Labour infighting story. It cuts you off from your grassroots who are going to go out there and do the campaigning for you. And it also turns out a sizable chunk of young, socially progressive voters who could mean the difference between, you know, a Labour or a Tory seat in an urban setting.
Now, there is a silver lining for people who are worried that the Labour Party doesn't have any direction at the moment, because while reheated Milibandism might not be a particularly attractive prospect, the actual man, Ed Miliband, kind of does taste better reheated. Here he is speaking to Andrew Marr on Sunday.
I think that there is a coalition to be built in this country for a different approach in the future. You know, we've had in the last decade the financial crisis, the crisis of Brexit, and now the injustices and inequalities revealed by COVID. And I think they should all tell us something about the deep inequities of our country. And I think, you know, there's a big coalition to be built for that. We can't just carry on with business as usual. We're talking today about supporting businesses. There needs to be a new relationship between government and business. We're saying that we've got to suspend business rates for another 6 months to keep businesses going through this crisis. Maybe you wouldn't have expected that from Labour, but it's about government and business working together. A proper industrial strategy for the green jobs we need. Building up our public services again. Not making people live on 74 quid a week on universal credit. Not saying to poor kids, you can't get free school meals during half terms. Those are the values that Keir Starmer's fighting for and that we're fighting for.
Now, that was the first time I've heard someone on the Labour front bench actually sound like they know why they want to be in government.
I think Ed Miliband is a particularly strong performer these days. One, because there aren't very many people speaking in an impassioned way on the Labour front bench. And two, because he's now able to be himself, to say the things that I think he's always wanted to say. He's somebody who has maintained quite a productive and constructive relationship with parts of the left. You know, even after the sort of defeat of Corbynism in 2019, he's particularly interested in ideas which are generated by the sort of new ecology of left-wing think tanks, including Commonwealth and Autonomy. That's why he's such an ideas guy. And he can sort of root what Labour's talking about within a bigger vision of the economy, because that's very much where his head is at the moment. And I think there's also the element of, because he's no longer leader, and he doesn't have all these people around him going, hey, you know, tilt towards blue Labour. Oh, go for a bit more social conservatism. You really need to make your pitch to, you know, those homeowners who've paid off their mortgages. He can kind of enjoy that freedom and speak authentically. The thing which he, you know, was sort of excoriated for was a sort of sense that he was trying to be somebody that he wasn't and failing. You know, that was the sort of killer blow. Which I think did him in. And now he's just not held back by the same constraints.
Ash, it's been a pleasure as always. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for your support if you are a donor at navarramedia.com/support. And thank you for subscribing. If you're a subscriber, hit that like button. It helps us on the algorithm. For now, you've been watching Tisky Sour on Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.